or near her own birthday, but she left the space open for her mother to fill. "Around the end of September," Christina supplied slowly, the look of dread intensifying. Carmen knew, intellectually, that this was happy news on a lot of levels. Christina had a whole new life ahead of her. From about seventh grade onward, Carmen had feared the day she'd leave for college. She imagined she'd be leaving her single mother alone to defrost food and eat by herself night after night. Instead, this September, she'd be leaving a happy couple bursting with a new baby. And besides, Carmen was finally getting the sibling she had always professed to want. If she were a big and good person, she would be able to feel and appreciate this happiness. She would be able to congratulate and even hug her mother. But she wasn't a big or good person. She dashed too many such opportunities not to know the truth about herself. "It's kind of convenient in a way," Carmen stated, sounding robotic like she didn't much care. "Because you can just use my room for the nursery, right? I'll be going just before the baby comes, good planning." The corners of Christina's mouth quivered.
"It wasn't good planning. It wasn't planned like this."
"And you can even combine birthday parties. What a funny coincidence."
"Carmen, I don't think it's funny."
Christina's gaze was earnest and unwavering.
"I think it's serious, and I know you must have a lot of complicated feelings about it."
Carmen looked away. She knew she was being spooky. She could tell by the worry in her mother's eyes. Carmen was well known to whine and complain and lash out destructively. Christina's posture, much like that of a person girded for the arrival of a hurricane, indicated that she was ready for just such a lashing. Carmen didn't want to give her mother anything, not even that. Yes, Carmen did have feelings, and they were damming up behind her face, generating a mammoth pressure somewhere around the back of her eyes. Carmen was afraid her face might explode if she had too many more of those feelings just now. Silently, she handed her mother her vitamins and stood to leave. Earlier, she'd debated telling her mother that they'd fallen in the toilet, but as she strode out of the room, she figured she would just let her mother go ahead and eat them. Carmen hated herself right now, but she hated her mother a little bit more.
"Oh, Karma, I, of all people, won't dare congratulate you or anything. I swear I won't remind you how you always said you wanted a brother or sister like all those blankety-blank all people did to me. I feel your pain. I mean, couldn't they have just gotten a dog? I hope the Oreos provide comfort for at least an hour. Just eat the box and think later. I got the kind with extra stuff in the middle because I love you extra. Tibby."
The air in the dining hall of the Prin Valley Soccer Academy was charged in a peculiar way. Bridget felt goosebumpy and alert. She had an idea, but she didn't want to have that idea, to give it words or a picture. Or maybe she did want to have that idea, but didn't want to want the idea. Maybe that was it. The room was knotty pine from floor to ceiling. Wide planks for the walls, medium for the floor, skinny for the ceiling. It was filling up slowly with coaches, trainers, administrators, and blah, blah, blah. The campers wouldn't arrive until tomorrow. Every stranger looked like someone she knew. Her intensity made her invisible. She was seeing so hard she forgot about being seen. "B?" Diana's voice was behind her, but she didn't turn. Diana was a real friend, but she wasn't telling B what she needed to know, so B would find it out for herself. There was a long table to one side. On it were sodas and an industrial-sized coffee maker and a few plates of store-bought cookies, oatmeal with bits of raisin. Was it dread or hope that made her chest pound? Her toes clutched so hard inside her clogs they were falling asleep. She sensed the presence of a significant body just off her left shoulder. She wasn't sure with which sense she sensed it. He was too far away to touch him or to feel his body heat. He was too far behind her for her to see him. Until she turned, that is. Her eyes seemed to go in and out of focus. Was it him? Of course it was him. Was it him? Bridget? It was unquestionably him. His eyes were dark under dark, arching eyebrows. He was older and taller and different and also the same. Was he surprised? Was he happy? Was he sorry? Her hand went protectively to her face. He made a gesture as if to hug her, but he couldn't seem to bridge the strange air between them. The time came for her to say something, and then it passed. She stared at him in silence. Socially, she never cared much about covering her tracks. "How are you?" he asked her. She remembered that he was earnest. It was something she'd liked about him. I'm surprised," she said honestly. "I didn't realize you would be here."
"I knew you would be." He cleared his throat. "Here, I mean."
"You did?"
"They mailed out the staff list a couple weeks ago."
"Oh." Bridget cursed herself for not reading her mail more thoroughly. She hated forms, mother's maiden name, mother's profession, and between this camp and Brown, she'd had far too many of them. So he'd known. She hadn't. What if she had known? Would she have willingly tossed herself into a summer full of Eric Richman, breaker of hearts and minds? It was amazing, in a way, that he occupied space like a regular human being. He was so monumental to her. For these 2 years, he'd represented not only himself, but all the complicated things she'd felt about herself. He was looking at her carefully. He smiled when her eyes caught his.
"So, from what I hear, you haven't gotten any worse."
She looked at his mouth moving, but she had no idea what he was talking about. She did not disguise this.
"At soccer," he clarified.
She'd forgotten they were at soccer camp. She'd forgotten she played soccer.
"I'm all right," she said. She wasn't even sure what she was talking about, but she said it again because she liked the ring of it. "I'm all right."
Your chances of getting hit by lightning go up if you stand under a tree, shake your fist at the sky, and say, "Storms suck." Johnny Carson. The only adult person in Carmen's life who hadn't smilingly congratulated her about her upcoming baby sibling was Valia Caligaris, Lena's grandmother. Now, as Carmen sat at the counter in Lena's family's glossy kitchen, and Valia sat at the breakfast table, Carmen felt grateful for that. Granted, Valia wasn't up for chatting these days. As Carmen waited for Lena to come back from the restaurant, Valia glowered at the Cheerios box and then trudged, still in her purple bathrobe, to the darkened den where she turned on the TV so loud Carmen could hear every word, even though it was two rooms away. It was a soap opera. Apparently, Dirk had abandoned Raven at the altar the very day before her identical twin sister Robin went missing. Carmen could privately ridicule it because it wasn't her soap opera. Her soap opera, to which she had become progressively addicted since she'd been accepted to William's early decision in January and stopped doing her homework, was called Brawn and Beauty, and it would never have a plotline as dumb as this one. Carmen's addiction centered on one actor, hailing from the Brawn side of things, named Ryan Hennessy. He was absolutely, explosively gorgeous and her one true love, no matter how much her friends made fun of her for it. He was a good actor. Seriously, he was. He'd done some sort of Shakespeare thing before he'd gotten the soap gig. At least, that was what Carmen had read in Soap Opera Digest, while she was waiting with Tibby to pay for the Diet Coke at the ANP the night before. The Caligaris' front door opened and closed, and Lena appeared with her mother a minute later.
"Hey, Karma."
Lena looked sweaty from her shift at the Elite. Ari was in her work clothes.
"Hi, how's work?"
Lena rolled her eyes.
"At least you have a job," Carmen pointed out. "How's the search going?"
Ari asked, pulling a pitcher of water from the fridge and filling a glass.
"Anybody?"
She held up the pitcher.
"No, thanks."
If Carmen had wanted something, she would have gotten it for herself. The Septembers had broken down that barrier at each other's houses before it had even gone up.
"The search is, slow. I'm kind of, not that much in the mood for babysitting this summer."
Carmen realized that if she didn't rush onward, she could be questioned on this topic.
But I saw this ad at the A&P to take care of an old lady 5 afternoons a week. She's kind of blind, I guess, so the job would mostly be reading to her. I called the number and left a message.
Ari put her glass down a little too forcefully on the granite counter. Lena turned to look at her mom.
You know, Ari said, her eyes animated. That's strange. I've been thinking about that same thing for Valia. I've been thinking how much she needs some companionship to help her with her errands and correspondence and maybe take her to a doctor's appointments. I don't dare take another afternoon off work this month.
Carmen nodded.
I was hoping Lena or Effie could pitch in, but they both got jobs early this summer.
Carmen kept her expression brightly neutral so as not to appear to indict Lena. Ari put her glass in the sink with a definitive motion.
How much were they offering to pay on the sign you saw?
She was getting quite enthusiastic now.
8 an hour? How about I'll pay you $8.50 if you look after Valia 30 or so hours a week? We could make up the schedule together.
Carmen considered, looking down at her chipped red nail polish. In this minute, she could go from having no job, no purpose in life, to having one. The money was decent. It would be a little weird to have Ari paying her. But then, it was more comfortable for Ari to hire Carmen than to hire a stranger. Carmen would frankly rather hang out in Lena's airy, spacious house than in what would likely be a stuffy old lady apartment.
Well, Carmen tapped her index finger on the counter. Okay, why not? Fantastic, Ari said.
Carmen hadn't looked across the counter at Lena before this moment, so she hadn't seen how Lena had positioned herself with her back to her mother and was facing Carmen, frantically wide-eyed, mouthing the word no and drawing her index finger across her neck until it was too late. Lena waited to explode until she'd gotten Carmen up to her room and shut the door.
Are you insane?
Lenny, geez, what's the problem?
Why do you think Effie and I set up jobs in mid-April? Jobs we both fully hate, by the way.
Because you're well organized? Lena shook her head stormily. Because you are ungrateful and uncaring granddaughters of your recently widowed and helpless grandmother?
Because Valia is a nightmare,
Lena practically shouted. It was a good thing Valia's hearing wasn't so good, Carmen thought.
I mean, she's an amazing and wonderful woman, Lena backtracked, looking more serious. She really is. And we love her, but she's awful right now. And I'm not saying I blame her for it. She's miserable about Bappy. She's miserable that she's in the States living with us. She hates my dad for making her come. She hates everything about this country. She wishes she were in her own home surrounded by her friends. She is furious at everybody. Can't you tell that?
Carmen was now feeling stupid and a bit defensive. Maybe she is, but maybe I can handle it.
Lena shook her head. Trust me, you and Valia are not a good combination right now.
Carmen narrowed her eyes. And what's that supposed to mean?
Now, and for a long time, the best way Bridget knew to settle her mind was to run. Sometimes she felt that the meditative state of the long, quiet miles helped her think. Sometimes she felt that the pure exhaustion helped her not think. Sometimes she believed that she was running toward some sort of resolution, and other times she knew she was just plain running away. Still, it was what she did. This late evening run took her up and down country roads fringed by scrubby June green trees. The sinking sun poked an occasional sparkling ray straight into her eyes. When she got bored of the cars honking at her, was she posing a hazard in the fading light, or was it her hair? She leaped off the road. Another girl might have been scared to run through unfamiliar woods as darkness fell, but Bee wasn't. She knew she could outrun virtually any human being who might find her. And the bears in these parts weren't man-eaters, she was pretty sure. It was exhilarating, if anything. The forest was young and sparse, cut through every which way by paths. She followed a deep, wide bed where she imagined a river had once lain. She pictured herself striving in this same place when the river flowed. She ran until her thoughts shortened and no longer formed lines. They flashed and blipped. She didn't follow them around the corner. She simply felt things without any hows or whys. This was how she settled herself. Now the sun was entirely gone, and Bridget knew the light would soon disappear too. The light that stayed on after the sun always felt to her like an empty promise. Ahead of her, on the dirt bed, something caught her eye. It jostled her breath out of its rhythm and sent her brain spinning. It was less than 20 yards away, and it disturbed her. She slowed her pace to keep the distance from disappearing so fast. She wanted to run wide around it, but she wanted to face it too. She was back in Howes and Whys. It was a bird, she thought. A pigeon, maybe. It was clearly dead and bent into a wrong set of angles. Its head seemed to stick up from the ground in a pitiful pose. She was nearly upon it. She wouldn't stop. She would keep going. She would avert her eyes. No, she couldn't avert her eyes. It wasn't until she was literally over the bird that she realized in a burst that it wasn't a bird at all. It was a mitten. It was a lost, grayish mitten with the thumb sticking up and looking very much like the head of a bird. She was instantly flooded by relief and reassessment. Her mind and body fell back into calm alignment. But as she ran and ran, and the sky turned a dark, bruised blue, she felt sad. And strangely, even though the twisted body in her path had been a mitten, she found herself remembering it as a bird. If Lena's mother's car had not overheated, it wouldn't have happened. The whole summer would have gone differently. But her mother's car did overheat on Thursday afternoon, so Lena borrowed her father's car on Friday and dropped him at work on her way to drawing class. It was easily on the way. In fact, as she drove away from her father, who was already sweating through his white shirt, she considered absently that it was only a short walk from his office building to her class, but at the time it didn't signify anything. By mid-morning, she was deeply immersed in her drawing. At Anique's instruction, the model, Andrew, took 5-minute poses. For the first few poses, Lena felt so harried she could barely get a gesture out of the tip of her charcoal. But then those 5 minutes began to stretch out for her. The intensity of hurrying stayed, but the consciousness of time dropped away, just as her awareness of the model's nakedness had completely bewitched her during the first few days and subsequently floated off. In hindsight, she felt ashamed of her juvenile, red-faced self. To the seasoned artists in the class, Andrew's nudity was about as sexually charged as Lena's coffee cup. Lena now observed Andrew's body in extreme detail, staring without a vestige of shyness at the hollow inside his hip and the sharp ridge of his shin. When she passed deeply into this creative state, she didn't really have thoughts anymore. The muscles that controlled her arm bypassed her thinking brain, linking directly to her autonomic system. The usual Lena was just along for the ride. She jumped when the timer rang out for the long break. A shiver radiated from her shoulders. She hated coming up to the surface like this. She didn't want to hear Phyllis's newspaper rustling and Charlie's heels slapping around in his sandals. She didn't want Andrew pulling on his robe, not for the reasons you might think. No, really, though the truth was she did regain the awkward mindfulness of Andrew's bare skin in that second when he'd pull on the green kimono, and again in that second when he'd take it off. She just wanted to draw. She just wanted to stay in that place where she understood things without thinking about them. As Lena stared wistfully at her empty coffee cup, she recognized, almost abstractly, her happiness. Leave it to her to detect happiness rather than actually feel it. Maybe it wasn't happiness precisely. Maybe it was more like peace. At the end of the previous summer, her peace had been sliced up like roast beef. The tumult had brought with it a certain strange exuberance, a feeling of living more extravagantly than ever before. But it had also sucked. She thought back to the end of that summer when she had first met Paul Rodman, Carmen's stepbrother. Her response to him had taken her by surprise. She had never experienced such an instant physical attraction to anybody, not even Costas. In Paul's presence that first time, she had spun these out-of-character fantasies about what she could mean to him and he to her. But after he left, she retreated, as was her wont. Her romantic side went back into hiding, and after some time, her timid side took over, timidly, again. Now when she thought about him, she felt ashamed. He was one of the many things she'd been hiding from this year. He was one of the people she'd been avoiding. In February, she had first heard from Carmen that Paul's father was sick. She felt awful about it. She had thought about Paul, she had worried for him, but she hadn't called him or written as she'd meant to. She had learned since from Carmen that Paul's father was sicker and would likely not be getting better. She didn't know what to say to Paul. She was afraid of his sadness. She was afraid to elicit his feelings. She was also afraid not to. She was afraid she would bring it up, and there would fall that most inept failure between them. Total silence. It wasn't until this class, this feeling, that she had regained a sense of balance. The time she spent with her charcoal in her fingers and her broad pads of paper, and Andrew and Anik and these deep, stabilizing stretches of meditation, it all felt like too big a gift to be received. She would have to work to receive it. Her heart soared at the sound of the timer indicating the break was over. Back to work. It was amazing how much she could hate and love the very same sound. And so began the fateful pose. For starters, it was unfortunate that the door opened in the middle of the pose, when Lena was least able to process what was happening. It was unfortunate that the person who walked through the door was Lena's father. It was also unfortunate that the door was located near the model stand and that Andrew was oriented in such a way that the first thing you saw upon bursting through the door in the middle of a pose, which you really weren't supposed to do, was a very up-close look between Andrew's legs. It was particularly unfortunate that Lena didn't recognize all of these unfortunate things in time to soften her father's experience, but instead unwittingly treated her father to a long stretch of her unabashed fixation upon the glories of Andrew. When her father started talking over loud, she came to. He was looming over her. It was a rude transition. It took her a moment to find any words.
"Dad, you are... Dad, you didn't... Dad, come on, let me just..."
She started a lot of other sentences, too. The next thing she knew, he had his hand clamped around her arm and was steering her back through the door, turning her forcibly away from Andrew. Anik appeared in the hall with amazing speed.
"What's going on here?" she asked calmly.
"We are leaving,"
Mr. Caligaris blustered.
"You are?"
she asked Lena.
"I'm not," Lena said faintly.
Mr. Caligaris exclaimed three or four things in Greek before he turned to English.
"I will not have my daughter in this place where she is.
Lena could tell her father wouldn't use the necessary descriptive words in her earshot. When it came down to it, her father was a deeply conservative and old-fashioned man. He'd grown even more so since Poppy's death. But long before that, he'd been way stricter than any of her friends' fathers. He never let boys up to the second floor of their house, not even her lobotomized cousins.
Anik stayed cool. "Mr. Caligaris, might it help if you and Lena and I sat down for a few minutes and discussed what we are trying to do in this class? You must know that virtually every art program offers..."
"No, it would not," Mr. Caligaris broke in. "My daughter is not taking this class. She will not be coming back."
He pulled Lena through the hall and out onto the sidewalk. He was muttering something about an unexpected meeting and coming to find her to get the car back and look what he finds. Lena didn't manage to pull away until she was standing in the harsh sunshine, dazed and off balance once again.
It's like, how much more black could this be? And the answer is none. None more black. This is Spinal Tap. How bad could it be?
That was what Carmen asked herself as she fixed Valia a cup of tea first thing when she arrived at the Caligari's house early Monday afternoon and brought it into the den where Valia was watching TV.
Awful!
Valia nearly spat when she tried the tea.
What did you put in this?
Well, tea. Carmen was being patient. And honey?
I said sugar.
The sugar bowl was empty.
Sugar and honey is not the same. American honey you cannot eat.
You can if you want, Carmen began, but realized this was not a diplomatic avenue. Here, I'll try again. She took the teacup back into the kitchen. She located the box of Domino granulated white sugar on the high shelf in the pantry. She refilled the sugar bowl. While she waited for the water to boil a second time, her mind traveled to September. From a chilly distance, she imagined her mom very pregnant. She imagined a baby shower. She imagined her room filled with expectations for somebody else. When she used to think about September, she imagined herself arriving at college, meeting her roommate for the first time, unpacking her stuff. Now she could only seem to picture what would be going on in her absence, and in those pictures, it was as though she were dead, or as though she were the one who hadn't yet been born. She used to be able to look forward to college. She had dreamed of Williams for so long. It was one of the best colleges in the country, the place her dad had gone. As agonizing as it was to leave her friends, college was something she'd really wanted. Why couldn't she want it anymore? She was angry. She wasn't angry at the baby, exactly. How could she be? She wasn't angry at her mother. Well, she sort of was, but that wasn't the real root of it. She was angry that she couldn't picture her own life anymore. She was angry that her mother and this baby had somehow stolen her future and plunged her back into the past. The pressure was building up behind her eyes again. Reflexively, she snatched the phone from the wall. Hey, it's me, she said when Tibby answered.
You okay?
Tibby asked. It was so nice how a person who loved you could pick up on your mood in three small words. Carmen could hear Nikki shouting about something in the background. I guess. How about you?
Nikki, could you do that in the other room?
Tibby called away from the phone. Suddenly, a beeping sound overwhelmed the connection. Tibby? Beep, beep, beep. Hello?
Sounds like a modem, Tibby had to shout over the noise. It must be from your end.
Carmen hung up the phone and went into the den. Sure enough, Valia had moved from the TV to the desk and was steering the computer's mouse like a race car. Carmen watched in surprise as Valia expertly negotiated her way through a series of menus into a rapid instant messaging conversation, presumably with somebody in Greece, considering that Carmen couldn't read a single letter. She was used to the look of the Greek letters from all her years in the Caligari's household, but she couldn't tell you what sounds any of them made. Carmen was supposed to help Valia with her correspondence? And here she had been picturing crumply airmail paper in blue envelopes.
What?
Valia turned around somewhat belligerently, obviously feeling Carmen's eyes on the back of her uncoiffed head.
Nothing. Wow, you really know what you're doing.
Carmen decided to be mature and not mention how Valia was hogging up the phone line when she really wanted to talk to Tibby. Instead, she sat down in one of the comfortable TV chairs, mindlessly picked up the remote, and started flipping channels. Brawn and Beauty would be starting in 7 minutes. She settled back into the chair, resting her heavy head. How bad could it be, spending the summer watching her favorite soap and getting paid while Valia burned up the lines IMing her Greek friends?
Not that channel.
Valia had turned from the computer, her hands still poised over the keyboard.
What do you mean?
I like Channel 7. The world apart.
But you're not even watching. You're on the computer.
Carmen could hear her own voice rising.
I like to listen,
Valia proclaimed.
But I like to watch, Carmen said tartly.
Who's the one getting paid?
Ouch. Carmen felt as though Valia had bit her. She felt the flush rising in her cheeks.
Well, could you get off the computer then? You're hogging up the phone line, Carmen snapped in a manner that was not very mature.
Tiburon, how's it going with the ancient Greek?
Carmabel, ahem, not bad. Not bad. Not good, if you see what I mean.
Just tell me every single thing. After that, you can drink your smoothie.
Tibby felt her heart rising again. Carmen's enthusiasm was everything she could wish for. She shook her clear plastic cup of frothy pink smoothie so it wouldn't separate.
Well, first, we danced to that.
Carmen was waving her hands around.
No, back up. I want the beginning. I want to hear the whole thing, soup to nuts.
Tibby smiled in spite of herself. She liked sitting outside under the umbrella at the smoothie place on Old Georgetown Road, feeling the sun bake her calves. She crossed her legs and let her green plastic flip-flop drop onto the hot sidewalk. Truth was, she wanted to tell the whole thing, soup to nuts. It made it real again.
Okay, so back up to my house. Doorbell rings. Catherine opens the door. He's wearing the suit jacket and tie, kind of short in the arms and obviously cheap, but so cute. And he has...
Tibby wished her face weren't turning pink, but she couldn't help it.
A bunch of flowers. Dyed pink carnations, fairly hideous, you know, like flowers only a boy would buy, but totally perfect.
Tibby needed to stop and breathe or she was going to pass out. At that moment, her cell phone rang faintly from the lower reaches of her straw bag. She pulled it out and squinted to see the number. It was her mother's cell phone. Hello? Nobody was there at first. She heard background noise, and then she heard her mother saying something to someone else. She sounded strange. Hello?
Tibby?
Her voice was ragged.
Are you okay?
Her mother was crying.
Mom, are you okay? What's going on?
Tibby felt a frigid load of adrenaline hit her bloodstream.
Honey, Dad and I...
Alice broke off. Her crying was too thick to make words. She could hear her father's voice in the background shouting. Tibby stood up, jamming her foot back into her shoe.
Mom, please, tell me what's going on. You're scaring me.
Her mom took a few seconds to get her breath. Tibby had never heard her sound like this before. It set her mind swirling and leaping spasmodically with fearful possibilities. She paced around the table.
What?
Carmen was mouthing urgently.
We're at the hospital. Catherine is hurt.
Alice paused to gain control of her breaking voice again.
She fell out the window.
Tibby couldn't move or think. Waves of cold rolled through her body. Hot hysteria began to brew under her ribs.
Is... she okay? She's conscious. She's...
Her mother's sobs took on a more hopeful tone.
That's a good sign.
Should I come? Tibby asked.
No. Please go home and look after Nikki, okay?
Yes, I'll go. Tibby was crying now. Carmen's eyes were tearing and she didn't even know what had happened. Tibby needed to ask a question that summed up her dread, but she was afraid. So she waited until the connection was dead. Which window? Lena sat on the back steps of the restaurant during her break. Inside was hot, outside was hot. She was sticky and her apron was spattered with tomato sauce. It looked vaguely gory, like maybe a customer had made one nasty comment too many. She hated this job. She hated the careless food, all hurried and overcooked in vats. She hated the constant pressure to turn tables over. She hated the green vinyl booths and the way the coffee cups rattled in their saucers, filling the saucers with hot coffee, which she inevitably spilled on her apron. She felt embarrassed by the lame painting of the Parthenon frieze that stretched across an entire wall of the dining room. She hated the fake windows and the fake ivy. She was bothered by the fact that her manager, Antonis, the one with the fuzzy gray hair spilling out of his ears, still thought she spoke Greek in spite of several one-sided conversations. She would happily sit out here in the back alley and smell the garbage if it meant not being in there. She needed time by herself. She was constantly being talked at, complained to, harassed. Even the polite customers were always waving her down, catching her eye, needing her to bring one more thing.
Some people liked being in communication with other people all day long, but Lena was not one of them. Looking back on the relative peace of Basia's clothing store the summer before made it seem like a dream job. Her father had pressed hard for the restaurant job. He had personally recommended her to the owner of the Elite. It was what his parents had done back in Greece. It was the life he had grown up in. Since his own father's death, less than a year before, these things had become more important to him. For most of his life, her dad had rebelled against Bobby and against his upbringing. He had eschewed the restaurant business in favor of law school. He had changed his name from Yorosh to George. He made a point of being American, not even teaching his daughters to speak Greek. It seemed sad to Lena that he had waited until his father was dead to start caring about the stuff his father had always wanted him to care about.
"The restaurant business is very practical," her dad had told her on several occasions, implying that being an artist was not very practical. "It's a good business," he'd say, and she was sure it was a good business, for somebody else. She sort of wondered whether he'd ever stopped and considered who she was. Did he really imagine she was going to start a restaurant in the proud Caligari's tradition? Could he not see how wrong it was for her? It had been 4 days since the disaster in her drawing class. She hadn't been back and she was missing it terribly. She could stand this job if she had her drawing to look forward to. She could tolerate Valia's loud misery and her parents' tension at home if she could draw. But without it, she felt like she was sinking. She could take some other class, maybe. There were still openings in metalworking and mixed media and something called gender issues in three-dimensional representation, but she knew in her heart she wasn't going to be that kind of artist. Her love of art wasn't particularly philosophical or political. She wasn't an avant-gardist or a rule-breaker. She wanted to learn to draw and paint people like Anik could. Back in April, she'd visited Capitol Street to pick up an application for summer classes. There were lots of showy, strange pieces in the gallery when you first walked in, but they didn't mean much to Lena. Then, just as you turned the corner to the office, there was a quiet, simply framed drawing on the wall. It was a figure drawing of a young woman holding her hair back with one hand. It was quiet, but so beautiful it made Lena's throat ache. It gave her chills from her scalp down to the balls of her feet. The drawing not only exhibited technical mastery and intricate detail, but it contained so much grace, so much feeling, it made Lena know what she wanted to achieve in her life. Lena had squinted down at the messy signature and then compared it to every teacher's name in the brochure. Anik Marchand. Lena walked into the office of the art school with uncharacteristic boldness and signed up for Anik Marchand's figure drawing class on the spot. For that drawing alone, she loved Anik before she'd even met her.
"Break it down,"
Antonis called at 3:30, indicating the end of the lunch shift. Lena put chairs on tables so the busboys could mop the floor. Then she faced the unhappy prospect of going home. She cared deeply for Valia. That's partially why Valia's surliness made Lena so sad. Instead of taking the bus north, Lena took it south. She got off and walked a block to the Capitol Street School of Art and Design. She didn't intend to go back to class, exactly. She just wanted to stop by and say something to Anik. The class was just setting up. Even the look and smell of the studio raised Lena's mood. Anik turned, and when she saw it was Lena, she rolled over in her wheelchair. She looked happy and a little surprised.
"Nice to see you," she said.
"I'm not really here to draw," Lena said.
"Why not?"
"Well, the whole thing with my dad," she waved her arm in the direction of Andrew. "My dad's pretty tough when he makes a decision. He already got most of his money refunded."
Lena glanced down at her fingers, her nails bitten short.
"I really just came by to say thanks."
"For what?"
Anik asked.
"For your teaching. I wasn't here long, but it's a great class."
Anik sighed.
"Listen, I've got to help set up. Why don't you stay for a few minutes, until the first break? You're welcome to draw if you want. I've got extra pads and charcoal, or you can do whatever. Then we'll have a chance to talk for a minute."
Okay, Lena said. She didn't really want to leave anyway. She would stay and water the plants if that were her only excuse. Anik left supplies out on a free easel. It was like leaving drugs out for an addict. It had been Lena's easel, that's why it was free. At first, Lena just stood in the back of class and watched people draw. Then her fingers started itching for a piece of charcoal. She ambled over to the easel, just drawing with her eyes at first. She hesitated. Then she picked up the charcoal, and she was lost until the bell rang. Anik came over. That's lovely, she said, studying the three poses of Andrew laid out on the sheet. Do you want to go outside and talk for a minute? Okay. Lena expected they'd talk in the hallway, but Anik led her down the hall, up a ramp, and out into the courtyard. Anik rolled up to a bench, and Lena sat down on it. The dogwood trees rustled, and a small fountain gushed appealingly in the middle. Various sculptures and found object works, one involving a stack of car tires, decorated the perimeter. Are you comfortable drawing, Andrew? She asked. Anik's hair was a beautiful red, made only more so by the sunlight. There was orange and gold and chestnut and even pink in it. Anik was fairly young, Lena realized, probably in her late 20s, and her face was delicate and pretty. Lena wondered absently if there was a man who loved her. Yes, Lena said. I felt a little awkward the first day, but then it went away. I don't think about it anymore. That's what I thought, Anik said. How old are you? 17. I'll be 18 at the end of the summer. Anik nodded. Can I tell you what I think? Lena nodded. I think you should take the class. I think I should too. I wish my dad felt that way. Anik put her hands on her wheels like she was getting ready to roll away. Lena wondered, as she had many times before, what had happened to Anik that made her need a wheelchair. Had she always been in a chair, or had she grown up on her legs like a regular kid? Had she had an accident or a disease? Lena wondered what of Anik's worked and what didn't. Could she have a baby if she wanted to? Though Lena wanted to know, she didn't dare ask. She shied away from the intensity that might come from asking such a question. Intimacy came faster when a person wore their pain and poor luck for all to see. And yet, not asking felt like an act of neglect or cowardice. It kept a distance between them that Lena regretted. Anik rolled back and forth a little, but she didn't go anywhere just yet. You do what you need to do, she said. Lena wasn't sure whether this meant take the class or listen to your father, but she had a pretty strong suspicion it was the former. I'm not sure how I'd pay for it, for one thing, Lena mused. I'm allowed a second monitor, Anik said. You'd need to help set up and clean up every day, including mopping, but you'd get free tuition. I'll do it, Lena said instantly, not aware of making the decision. Anik smiled openly. I'm so glad. I'm not sure what I'm going to tell my dad, Lena murmured half to herself. Tell him the truth, Anik said. Lena shrugged, knowing that this was the piece of Anik's advice she was not going to take. There are many things that we would throw away if we were not afraid that others might pick them up. Oscar Wilde. Tibby sat frozen on a chair in the den, watching Nikki watch cartoons. Her thoughts came together and broke apart, occasionally punctured by the sadism of Tom and Jerry. Her whole body hurt. Every bone ached when her mind flashed on Catherine. She let herself think of Catherine for only a second at a time, and then she pulled away because it hurt too much. Nikki didn't know anything yet. They didn't want to scare him. Whereas Tibby was good and scared, wanting desperately for the phone to ring, but only if it was good news. Tibby was not raised religious. For the early part of her childhood, her parents were devout atheists, spewing Marx's opiate of the masses rhetoric. Nowadays, Tibby wasn't sure what they believed. They didn't talk about it anymore. But Tibby was not them. As far as Tibby was concerned, you couldn't have someone you loved, really loved, die and not believe in some kind of God. It was the only way to look at it. And besides, Bailey herself, as she had lived, not as she had died, had been proof that somebody or something existed beyond the realm of rational things. And when Tibby thought of Bailey, it made sense, because a god who was smart enough to want Bailey back as soon as possible was also smart enough to see the beauty of Catherine. Catherine was too good for the world Tibby lived in. Tibby belonged there just fine, but not Catherine. Catherine was brave and generous and passionate. If she weren't on God's dance card, then who would be? Tibby would stand in the corner of heaven if she ever made it there, but Catherine, like Bailey, would be doing the polka or the bunny hop or maybe the bus stop with God.
Please don't take her yet, Tibby implored. She's only 3 and we love her too much to survive without her.
Tibby was asking selfishly, because she knew it was her fault. She had opened a window that was always shut. Why had she done that? She knew Catherine wanted to climb the apple tree. She knew that was how Catherine fell out the window.
It wasn't on purpose. Please, God, believe that.
It was an accident. It was horrible, but not nearly as horrible as the ways in which Tibby had failed her little sister on purpose. Tibby was jealous and resentful. She hurt Catherine's feelings on the pretense that small kids didn't have actual feelings. And yet, Tibby knew in her heart they did. Possibly the deepest feelings of all. If Tibby had loved Catherine as she deserved, maybe she wouldn't have fallen out the window. If Tibby had paid attention to her and given her a boost to the branch of the apple tree, then Catherine wouldn't have been climbing out anybody's window. If Tibby hadn't been so preoccupied with Brian, maybe this wouldn't have happened. Love was the best padding anybody could have. And though irrepressible Catherine deserved it a million times over, Tibby hadn't given it.
I do love her. God, I love her so much.
Tibby just wanted a chance to do better. The phone rang and Tibby threw herself on top of it.
Tibby.
It was her dad. She ran the phone into the kitchen so Nikki wouldn't hear.
Dad?
Her body was shaking.
Honey, she's doing better. The doctors say she's going to be okay.
Tibby gave herself full permission to cry now. She wept and sobbed and heaved and shook. Her dad was doing similar things on his end.
Can I come?
She asked.
She's still getting x-rays. Her skull is fractured, which is the most serious thing. She also broke her wrist and her collarbone. We're hoping that's the extent of it. She's talking and alert now, but I'd rather you stay home with Nikki for a couple more hours. Bring him over around 6 when things settle down here, okay?
Okay. But I want to see her so bad, Daddy.
Tibby's voice got swallowed up in tears.
I know, honey. You will.
Tib, it's me, Karma. We've been terrified all day. Lenny made me stop calling your house, and then she called 5 more times. I'm so glad Kay's gonna be okay. I'm thinking about you. Please call when you get a second. I love you. Beep.
Tibby, it's B. God, Lena called me here to tell me about Catherine. I'm still shaking. She's gonna get better so fast, though, I know it. Call me. Love you.
Beep. Tib, sorry, I kept calling before. It's Lenny. I just couldn't stand waiting. I'm so glad the news is good. I'll come visit tomorrow, okay? Hang in there. We love you.
Beep.
And I saw it really close, so I wanted to get it.
Catherine was propped up on pillows in her hospital bed, slightly woozy from medication, but still eager to recount her adventure to Tibby and Nikki, who were both sitting cross-legged on the foot of her bed. Tibby nodded eagerly, trying not to show her agony at each word of the retelling. Her heart ached at the sight of Catherine's bruised, bandaged head, her cast, her sling, and multiple cuts and scrapes. It was made almost more heart-rending by the fact that Catherine didn't seem to notice.
I couldn't reach it, so I climbed.
Here she looked remorseful.
I'm not supposed to climb, but I almost got it, so I climbed more. And then,
she looked to Nikki for this bit.
I falled.
Nikki was entranced. Rarely had his sister done anything so interesting.
On the ground?
He asked breathlessly.
First, I grabbed on the bottom of the window, she explained. I tried to climb back in because my fingers hurt because I was hanging.
Nikki nodded, eyes wide and unblinking.
I couldn't climb back in, so I saw the soft bushes and I falled.
Oh, Nikki murmured.
They aren't very soft because I crushed my skull,
Catherine added conversationally.
Catherine! Tibby could not take this. The images were too awful to bear. She turned her head to get hold of herself. When she turned back, she lay across the bed on her stomach and grabbed Catherine's two bare feet. She tried to smile.
You are so strong and brave, you know? She turned to Nikki. Isn't she? She knew his was the compliment Catherine would treasure.
Yes,
Nikki said solemnly.
But you have to promise you will never do something like that again, right?
I promised. I already promised Mommy and Daddy that.
Tibby held the pair of small feet up to her face, pressing one to each cheek, and closed her eyes. She was overcome by tenderness and relief, mixed with guilt and regret. She breathed deeply and willed back the tears. She didn't want Catherine to see any more crying.
Brian!
Catherine shouted, with remarkable glee for a girl who had, in fact, crushed her skull less than 8 hours earlier. Tibby looked up. She had already felt so many things today, she couldn't imagine feeling any more. Brian's face was wrenched, but he kept his expression bright as he came over to hug the non-injured parts of Catherine.
You are all in one piece, kitty cat, he said. Good job.
Catherine beamed.
I falled out Tibby's window.
Brian cast the briefest of glances at Tibby, but she could read in it his protectiveness of her.
That's what I heard.
Tibby wondered how he'd heard. It was so like him just to come over to the hospital. Tibby let Catherine's feet go as Brian looked at her in his particular way, projecting all the things he was thinking from his eyes to hers. He was worried about Catherine, but he was worried about Tibby too. He wanted her to feel better, not to feel bad or responsible. He also wanted, or did she imagine this? To convey to her that what had happened between them had really happened, that he meant what he had said to her. She wanted something too, just one little thing, for them to go back to how they were before. Carmen lay on her bed thinking about Catherine, worrying about Tibby, and generally wondering things. Her mother was sleeping even though they'd finished dinner only an hour before. Once again, David had not made it home in time for dinner. David was working on a big case. Seeing his schedule up close convinced Carmen that she did not ever want to become a lawyer. At least not the kind David was. For a few weeks, he'd come home by 7 most nights for dinner, but in the last month, he never came home before 11, and even at that hour, he was fielding calls on his cell phone. A few times, he'd left home for the office one morning and hadn't come home until the next morning. Then he'd taken a shower and gone back again. Carmen had always suspected that people who worked that hard secretly didn't want to come home, but she knew that wasn't true of David. He was desperate to be home with Christina. He adored her. Carmen could see that he felt genuinely guilty and sad for every dinner he missed. And that was pretty much all of them. According to Christina, he was working on a big deal. One gigantic company gobbling up a different gigantic company, as Carmen understood it. And all David wanted to do was finish this big deal before the baby came, which was why he worked 20 hours a day. Carmen studied her ceiling, dotted with the glowing constellation stickers she'd excitedly arranged there when she was 8. There should be a law disallowing 8-year-olds from decorating their rooms, especially where stickers were involved. Why had her 8-year-old self saddled her 17-year-old self with so many dumb decals and see-through unicorn window appliques? They were impossible to get off. The truth was, she continued to have a soft spot for the glowing stars, but tonight they made the ceiling seem closer rather than farther away. Thinking about her 8-year-old self reminded her of her 4-year-old self, who was responsible for packing her closet with so many beautified, mangled, dolls. And that reminded her of her baby self, who had also inhabited this very room. And that, of course, reminded her of babies again. She wanted to leave a hole when she left for college. That was selfish, maybe, but she did. She wanted to step out of the picture of her old life and leave a big, generous cutout waiting for her return, giving her the chance, at least, to come back. But now it felt like the minute she stepped out of her life, it was going to close up around her as if she'd never been there at all. The picture would reform almost instantly with a new family in the place of her old one, and she could never come back again. That was how it felt to her. She was scared to disappear. She was scared to lose her place. The ceiling was pushing down on her. The pressure beneath her eyes was pushing up. She felt like her eyeballs were in a vise. She got out of bed and turned on the light. She wiggled her mouse to wake her sleeping computer. She went online, and without really planning to, she brought up the website for the University of Maryland. Slowly, she clicked around inside the site. It was the usual higher education propaganda. She found herself clicking on the admissions link, and from there to the online application. The university offered rolling admissions. She wondered if they were still rolling. Her hand caused her to click on the print icon. Her eyes lighted ever so briefly on the stack of booklets and papers from Williams College. Health forms, dorm info, a course guide, a map showing the leafy spot in western Massachusetts where the campus lay, more than 7 hours north of home. She listened to the buzz and spit of her printer and wondered, what if she didn't go away after all? What if she didn't disappear? Aerodynamically, the bumblebee shouldn't be able to fly, but the bumblebee doesn't know it, so it goes on flying anyway. Mary Kay Ash.
I took on an extra shift at work, Lena told her father at dinner when he asked about her day. I'm going to do the first dinner shift from 4 to 7.
She looked down at her pasta as she said it.
Excellent, her father said.
How is little Catherine doing?
Her mother wanted to know.
Did you get to stop by there today?
Yeah.
Lena smiled at the thought of Catherine's excited retelling. The tragedy had become the single most thrilling incident in Catherine's short life.
She's great, only she has to wear a hockey helmet till the end of the summer.
I wore a hockey helmet, Effie recalled, scraping her salad fork annoyingly across her plate. Didn't I, Mom?
For a week, Ari answered. You had a concussion, not a fracture, thank God.
Lena chewed a piece of bread. What was it about little sisters smashing their heads? Lena had never had so much as one stitch.
What kind of sauce do you call this?
Valia asked in an overloud voice.
Pesto,
Lena's mother said with finality.
It does not taste good.
Valia inspected it with her fork. They were all quiet and waited for the moment to pass. Even Effie had been ground down into acquiescence. A while later, Lena stood at the sink doing the dishes. She stiffened when she heard her grandmother pad into the kitchen behind her.
I did IMs with Rina today.
Oh?
Lena did not turn around. She did not like these conversations.
She tells me Costas and that woman are not living together now.
Lena closed her eyes and stood with her hands in the warm suds. She was glad Valia could not see her face. Valia had many things to be bitter about, and Costas was one of them. Her greatest dream was to have her handsome, beloved surrogate grandson, Costas, marry her beautiful granddaughter, Lena. She didn't seem to realize that her own hurt and disappointment were magnified 1,000 times in Lena herself. If she had, maybe she wouldn't have brought up the news from Oya as often as she did. The baby expected by Costas and Mariana, the reason for their hasty marriage and Lena's heartbreak at the end of the previous summer, did not materialize. That was the first thunder strike to arrive sometime in December. Valia kept Lena roiling on this news for weeks. No one knew exactly why or what happened, but there was endless speculation. Valia was so biased, Lena doubted that any of her information was reliable. For all she knew, there was a bouncing baby Costas beloved by all. Then, as now, Lena both wanted these rumors to be true and she didn't. The better part of her didn't. It was all she could do to get over Costas and keep moving on with her life. She couldn't open her mind to any what-ifs or she would be hobbled by them. She didn't want to know about Costas. Whatever had happened, it was over. But still, she did want to know. Valia's very presence and her connection to Oya was a thorn in Lena's heart, aggravating the wound whenever it seemed to be healing.
Costas stays in an apartment in Votanas, near the airport. He has a job for a house-building company.
Lena couldn't control her thoughts. She would have if she could. Had the baby miscarried so that Mariana owned his sympathy? Or had it been a hoax so that Costas despised her? Had Costas grown to love his wife or hate her? Would there be a different baby if not the first one? These were the regular thoughts she'd had thousands of times. Now she had new ones to add. Were Costas and his wife really separating? Or was he temporarily relocating for a new job and she would soon join him? Lena would have considered electroshock therapy if it meant getting rid of these thoughts.
That's interesting, she said faintly to the wall. She couldn't let Valia see how these news bulletins affected her.
Valia launched into her opinions and Lena stopped listening. She finished up the pots and pans as quickly as possible, made a polite excuse, and rocketed up to her bedroom. She called Tibby and talked about nothing in particular. She cleaned her clean room. She got into bed with a book and tried, as she had so many other nights, not to think about Costas.
He's a little taller, don't you think?
Bridget's question floated up to the rafters a few feet above her head. Some of it made its way down to Diana in the bottom bunk.
Yeah, I guess.
Bridget tapped her toes against the metal rail at the bottom of her bunk. God, he is cute. In my memory, I didn't exaggerate that part of it.
Bridget.
It was the deep, slow, irritated voice of Katie across the cabin.
Yeah?
Will you shut up? Bridget laughed. She appreciated bluntness.
Okay.
She was happy. She couldn't help it. She was happy that Catherine was okay. She was happy that she felt happy instead of miserable at the thought of Eric Richmond sleeping in a bed less than 100 yards away. Bridget tapped her toes some more. She made a rhythm approximating walk on the wild side. She tried turning onto her stomach. She cleared her throat.
Can I say one other thing?
No, Katie barked, but her bark belied a certain amusement.
Please?
What is it, Bee? Diana asked wearily.
She'd had over 24 hours to digest the fact that she would be spending the summer with the mythical Eric. She'd seen him twice that day. They'd smiled at each other, though they hadn't spoken. She was getting the same fizzing feeling she'd had when she'd met him the first time. And that was dangerous, maybe. But she was different.